Good evening and welcome behind the news for May 6, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And I've got two segments up for tonight. First, we'll speak with the economist Heather Boucher in a Mother's Day segment. I'll talk about child care arrangements in the U.S. and then also segue into some stuff about what's happening with the job market, unemployment benefits, and such. So a wide-ranging look at the human side of the U.S. economy. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with, play an interview recorded a couple of weeks ago with Merrill Guzner, who is the author of a book called The $800 Million Pill, The Truth Behind the Cost of New Drugs, a book recently published by the University of California Press. And that is all about why drugs are so expensive and whether the pharmaceutical industry is lying to us when they claim that they're so expensive because of all those drug development costs. And, of course, the hint is that, they are lying to us. Surprise, surprise. It's been a while since I looked at the economic headlines, so let's take a look at some of those. Just focusing mainly on the story that we've been following here for months and months, the U.S. economic recovery. How serious, how broad, how sustainable is it? And the signs are looking more and more like this is an economic recovery, and let's review some of the evidence. First, the Institute for Supply Management, the group of purchasing managers, the people who buy supplies for corporations, they do a monthly survey of their membership to see what's happening with the state of business at the firms they work for. Purchasing managers are pretty familiar with the state of business because they have to buy everything from paper clips to drill presses. So we will they do two surveys: the Institute for Supply Management, one of manufacturing companies, and the other of service industries. And both released earlier this week, very strong numbers coming in for both manufacturing and service industries. The way these things work is that when they're over 50, it's a strong reading. When they're under 50, it's a weak reading, a sign of a contracting economy. The manufacturing index came at 62.4. The service index came in at 68.4. So both considerably above 50. The service index is relatively new, less than it's only about 7 years old, so it doesn't have quite the track record of the manufacturing one, which goes back into the late 1940s. So it does indeed track quite well with the state of the manufacturing side of the economy. But the service industries do like look, they're expanding as well, and a change from recent history. The employment components of both these indexes are well above 50 now. The manufacturing side, close to 58, and the service side, 54.5. So both of these are consistent with expansion in employment, considerable expansion in employment in both sectors. Now, these have both been over-predicting the health of employment in both services and manufacturing. That is, reality has not been living up to the promise of these indexes, so we'll see if that continues to be the case. But they are pointing upwards. The weekly ABC Money Magazine survey of consumer comfort, which is just a measure of how people feel about the state of the economy and the state of their own personal finances, that took a pretty strong dive between January and March, but it has now since been recovering and is at minus 11, which is not a strong reading, but considerably above the levels minus 22 that it was probing just a couple of months ago. People reporting that the economy looks better to them and also that their personal finances are looking better to them. And that suggests that finally, after a long delay, the job market is recovering. Further confirmation of that came from this morning's release of the weekly tally of first-time claims for unemployment insurance. That is, people who lose their jobs and head over to the unemployment insurance office and sign up for benefits. Very sensitive, very timely indicator of what's happening in the job market. That fell to 315,000 last week from 340 the previous week, and just a couple of weeks ago it was up to 360,000. And also the number of people continuing to draw benefits who've been unemployed for weeks, that number also fell to this indicator is at the best levels it's seen in a couple of years. So this is pointing to a considerable firming in the job market. And tomorrow morning, 8:30, brings the release of the monthly employment numbers, the tallies of job growth or lack of, and the unemployment rate and similar familiar indicators. And I'm expecting to see a reasonably healthy but not gangbusters report. Last month we learned that 308,000 new jobs were created in the U.S. in the month of March. I don't think we're going to see quite that many tomorrow morning, but I think we should see a number well into the six figures. So, again, finally, after a very, very long period of time, two and a half years of so-called economic recovery, with the job market not participating, it does seem to be kicking in, but slowly. And also, wages are not doing very well, so we'll see if that that trend has been continuing. But hourly wages have been going nowhere, a reversal of the strength they saw in the 90s boom. So we'll see if that persists. And also a couple other signs of less bullish signs, that is the monthly tally of chain store sales issued by the International Center for Shopping Centers. This is the business of America is shopping, of course. And that came in a little weaker than expected, so a weakening in the consumer side of things. And we also saw a surprisingly weak report on vehicle spending, people buying fewer cars and SUVs than they have been lately. And that's one wrinkle in this picture of a strengthening economy. They have been buying like crazy, using a lot of debt to do so. And it may be that consumers just really way overextended. We had a recession on the supply side of the economy, that is hiring and investment, but people kept spending through it. There was virtually no recession on the consumer side. Very unusual behavior. So we will see if those profligate consumers look foolish or wise if this economy, the economic recovery gains force or burns itself out over the next several months. I think there are still substantial structural problems that have to be dealt with our economy that have not yet been dealt with. So it could be that this is this recovery is a bit of a head fake and maybe undone, as often happens shortly after a presidential election. The fourth year of a presidential term is usually the strongest, and the first year of a presidential term is usually the weakest in the so-called presidential cycle. So we shall see. And I guess that's it for the economic headlines. I do want to take another look at the Indian economy. Most of these economic headlines are focusing on the U.S. And did a segment on the Indian economy a couple of months ago, and I think I want to do another one. Raj Patel, who is the chief economist at the Food First, the NGO out in the Bay Area in California, has just done a report on casting considerable doubt on the widely touted Indian economic miracle. Don't have time to work him in today, but when I come back after the fundraiser, I will get to that promptly. And also, more looks at China. What's going on there? Is China hitting the economic wall? Is its boom entering the flame-out phase, or is China really a long quest to economic superpowerhood? Maybe both those things are true. They could have a deep recession and still be on the way to overtaking the U.S. Eventually. So these are questions we'll be considering over the next several months. But now we're joined on the line by Heather Boucher, who is an economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and one of the authors of a study, a data brief, which is available at the CEPR website. That's CEPR.net. It's called Working Moms and Childcare. And Mother's Day is, of course, a holiday much beloved of chocolate makers and jewelers and florists. But the serious side of what it means to be a mother is often forgotten. So we're going to be the dismal scientists that we are and look at childcare arrangements in this country. Welcome to WBAI, Heather.
Thank you, Doug. It's great to be on the show.
Always good to have you.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be dismal scientists and talk about some of the less sentimental side of being a mom. What are people doing about childcare? It looks like it's pretty complicated and pretty expensive. And what's your report have to say?
Well, complicated and expensive are two words that certainly come to mind. You know, I think we need to start off by pointing out that the vast majority of mothers are now in the labor market and working, and that includes moms of kids under the age of six, preschool children and infants. And the majority of these moms work at least 30 hours a week. So child care is really a pressing concern for most American families with kids. Now, one of the things that our research shows is that for those who purchase child care, the costs are very expensive. As is, about one-third of working moms get child care from a relative or another family member, and another one-third use some sort of formal child care arrangement. They take their child to a daycare center or a preschool, some sort of institutional setting, as it were, for their kids. And for those folks who use formal daycare, they pay nearly $100 a week per child. So a mother who has two preschool kids is paying close to $180 to $200 a week for child care. And you have to note that this is just the average. There's a great distribution of how much people are paying, especially folks at the high end are paying more.
And you said some research showing that actually in, 15 states, they're actually people are spending more on child care than in college tuition?
Yes. There is some research from the Children's Defense Fund that does show that in 14 or 15 states, the average cost of putting your child in a daycare center is actually more than the state tuition for the local state university. So the costs are really quite high, and you also have to take into account that, when families are putting their children through college, it's usually parents in their 40s, 50s, or 60s who are paying or helping their children pay for a college education. When families are using childcare, the parents are generally quite young. The majority of mothers have their first child before the age of 25 in this country. And so we're talking about folks who are at the sort of the low end of their earnings profiles across the course of their lives. They probably don't have a lot of savings. And, of course, the toddlers can't help pay for their child care in the same way that college kids can help pay for their college education.
We'll just have to start putting young kids to work.
Exactly. That's the thing at the preschool center, so they can work off their child care. Yeah, but it's certainly tough, and it's really actually more tough for lower-income households. Although higher-income households actually pay more for child care on average than lower-income households do, for lower-income households, the share of child care as a share of total household income is much greater. It's about three times as big. So a low-income household is paying almost one-fifth of their total household income for formal daycare if they're using it, compared to a higher income family, which is only paying about a sixth of their total household income.
And many of these lower income households are already spending maybe a third to a half of their income on housing, so there ain't a lot left over.
Exactly, and it's very tough for them. And of course, this is where it's lower income households who could possibly even benefit most by placing their child in a formal daycare setting, in the sense that it's likely to be more educationally enriching, and importantly, it's more likely to help the mother stay employed. Low-income moms, and in fact all moms who use formal daycare, are more likely to stay employed over the long term because the centers are more stable. There's less likely to be issues like if you're using your sister or a friend or an informal daycare setting. Oftentimes those arrangements are only temporary, and that can lead to problems staying employed if the child care arrangement falls through.
And, of course, I suspect if Pat Robertson were here, he'd say, well, these moms should just stay home and take care of their kids. How practical is that as an option?
Not practical at all, especially given what we did in the mid-1990s with welfare reform. I mean, you know, to just go back to some of the basic trends, most moms are now working, and that's across the income distribution. And we've made it very difficult for low-income moms to not work. It's almost impossible for a low-income dad to support a family on his earnings alone, and increasingly he's not likely to get health insurance that would cover his wife or his children. And we've made it virtually impossible for low-income or poor women to get on welfare and to stay home and take care of their kids. So really these families have no option but to enter the labor market. And I would also add to that that over the long term, the way that our economy is set up and the way that the rules around our social insurance programs are set up, it's really not in the long-term interest of women and of mothers to take extensive time out of the labor market to care for their children. It's going to mean lower 401ks. It's going to mean that they're less likely to have health insurance. We're set up as a society now to have everybody work, What we haven't dealt with is how we're going to provide care for children and for the elderly and for the sick.
And, of course, there's a story on the front page of today's Wall Street Journal on just that, the problems of mothers who are trying to reenter the workforce after a long period of taking care of kids, and it's not an easy thing to do.
It is certainly not an easy thing to do. And it's going to lead to, not only is it hard to get back in the swing of things, back into a good job, but it lowers a woman's earnings relative to her male peers who, you know, they all graduated college at the same year, or graduated high school, and 10 years out, if the mother's taken a few years off, this is going to lead to a lifetime earnings penalty, which, again, will be related to how much pension she has and 401k and all these sorts of things.
As I remember the data, having a child lowers a woman's income and raises a man's income.
This is still the case. In fact, a lot of the research now on the gender gap is showing that the biggest gap is really between women with children and women without. So a lot of what we're seeing in terms of the penalty that women are facing in the labor market has to do with their caretaking responsibilities, and it's less, increasingly less about gender. Although there is still a pay gap just for being female, the gap is actually growing for having kids and shrinking a bit for just being female.
You did a report for CEPR some months ago, and you were on to talk about it, that people do also juggle a whole lot of different child care arrangements, right? It's just, I started by saying we're talking about the expensive side, but it's also complicated, right?
It's incredibly complicated, and it's increasingly difficult for families to find the kind of child care that they need. I believe it's about one-third of the families in our study are using more than one kind of care for their children, and that's a lot. That means driving your kid from one place to the other, and it's also really not only hard on the parent who's shuffling children around, and again, we're talking about children under the age of six, but it's also very hard on the child. We know from child development research that the best kind of environment for children where they'll thrive and grow and learn is a stable child care arrangement and one where there is some educational enrichment activities where the kids aren't just sort of plopped in front of a television. So using multiple kinds of care adds not only family stress, but can be to the long-term detriment of the child's development.
And of course, in America, we love kids and we love moms just as long as we don't have to pay for it.
Well, that's the big question. I mean, I think in so many ways, you know, over the past, you know, eons, mothers were providing this kind of care for their families for free. And we've now moved into a world where we expect mothers to work, and we expect the women who provide child care are also oftentimes mothers, and they have to work, but we don't want to pay them for this service. And we sort of balk when we think that women who provide child care, or child care workers in general, should be paid something close to a living wage. We really haven't come to terms with the fact that this is something that we have to pay for and that is incredibly important to our long-term societal development.
And I think the economist Barbara Bergman worked out some numbers that universal child care would cost something like $75 billion a year in the United States.
Yes, I believe the number, and I have the book too far away for me to actually grab here in my office. I believe it was $50 billion in added expenses on top of the money that we're already spending. But it was close to, you know, somewhere between $50 and $75 billion, which is a lot of money, but isn't a lot of money when you think of how much we're spending on other goods and services in our economy, how much we're spending on the war on Iraq, how much we gave in tax credits to the wealthiest American families over the past few years. And when we consider this an investment in our children's future, I think the number becomes more manageable.
Yeah, Bush is going back for another $25 billion for the Iraq War. Larry Lindsey got more or less fired for saying it's going to cost $200 billion, and he turned out to be right.
Yes, and yet we feel that we can't afford child care.
Anything happening in the legislative arena on child care?
Well, of course, the most money that we spend on child care at the federal level these days is through the welfare programs, through folks who are either on welfare or folks who just left welfare through either the Child Care Development Block Grant or through temporary assistance to needy families. So a lot of the debate around child care issues has been around the continuing crisis of TANF reauthorization that we've been dealing with here in Washington over the past few years. And what what's been going on is that Senator Snowe from Maine, who's a Republican, has proposed that we add an additional $6 billion to child care funds over the next 5 years as a part of welfare reform. And the House has passed only an additional $2 billion. So here in Washington, a lot of the welfare reform bill was held up over this issue, whether or not we should allocate $2 or $6 billion to child care. Of course, I'd like to point out that even this additional $6 billion over 5 years is less than 1% of the total federal budget. So really, we're arguing about peanuts, but that has been a major sort of debate here in D.C.
I'm speaking with Heather Boucher, who's an economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. And you can visit them on the World Wide Web at cepr.net. And you can download this study, Working Moms and Childcare, from their data brief number 3. And let's switch gears a bit and talk about the broad job market. What are you expecting for tomorrow morning?
Well, I'm being dismal. I'm being doubly dismal, more than normal. And I think that unemployment will probably go up a little bit, probably up to 5.8%. And I think we're going to see not as strong job growth as we saw last month, which was the 308,000, but something closer to 100, 150. And I actually think it's going to come in on the lower side, more so because it was such a strong growth last month. I think we're going to have to do a little bit of an adjustment. But I do hope that I'm wrong. I was listening to your comments as I was waiting for the interview to begin, and it sounds like you're a little bit more bullish on the economy.
Yeah,
right,
well,
I'm
thinking more like 150 to 175.
Yeah, it's a little bit closer to a consensus. I'm very concerned, though, about the extent of the long-term unemployed and how many folks have been out of work for so long, and that we've seen the employment-to-population ratios fall so much, and we've seen labor force participation fall. I do think we'll probably see more folks come back into the labor market, and so it doesn't look that good for those folks who are unemployed, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we won't see job creation.
Yeah, I was just looking at these numbers the other day. I think about even as recently as 6 or 8 months ago, about 48% of the unemployed were drawing benefits, and now it's down about 42. So a lot of people just dropping off the rolls, not necessarily getting reemployed, but just running out of their time on unemployment insurance.
Exactly. And you've been seeing an increase in the number of folks, as you just said, who've dropped off, an increase in the exhaustion rate, which is the folks who go through their 6 months of eligibility for unemployment insurance, and then they're kicked off. And that has continued to rise even over the past few months as we've seen some growth in the labor market. So even if we see growth, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be good news for all those workers who are unemployed, because we need to see this kind of growth month after month for the next few years to really make up for the millions of lost jobs that we've seen over the past since the recession began in 2001.
And I can't say this often enough, but we're some 8 million jobs below where we would be in a normal economic recovery, so there's a big deficit to make up.
Huge deficit, and we haven't seen the kinds of policies here in Washington that would have really led to the job growth that we'd like to see.
What kind of jobs are out there that you can see?
Well, I think one of the very unfortunate things that we've seen happen is that the kinds of jobs that folks are getting and the wage level for folks who are employed right now has been falling. So we've seen actual declines in inflation-adjusted wages over the past few months, which is, of course, a reversal of the trends that we saw since 1996 when wages were rising as the economy was tight. And I think there are some indications that part of the decline is the composition of jobs, and some of it is also just the higher unemployment rate. Of course, we have not seen job growth in manufacturing or really sort of productive sectors. Most of it has been in service sector employment over the past few months.
And it seems that, well, go back to the 80s, early 90s, when we had Republican presidents, the real wage was falling. The real wage rose in the late 90s, and now it's flat or falling again. Is there some partisan quality to this, or is this just a coincidence?
Well, my grandma thinks that there's a partisan quality to it, that we go into recession every time there's a Republican and we don't see wage growth. I do think that there is an element of that. And, for example, the last time we saw an increase in the minimum wage was during the Clinton administration in 96 and 97, and when the minimum wage rose to $5.15. That has now been 8 years since that legislation was passed, and of course we aren't seeing any real movement towards an increase in the minimum wage under this Republican-controlled Congress and administration. And that would go a long way, of course, towards helping workers at the bottom see real wage increases. So I do think that there are some real policy implications that are there, let alone just how the Republicans versus the Democrats are managing the labor market and what their priorities are.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, Heather.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I've been speaking with Heather Boucher, who's an economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research based in Washington, D.C., and you can visit them on the web and download this paper on child care, but also see many other things on globalization, the IMF, and intellectual property, all kinds of things. Think tank run by Mark Weisbrot and Dean Baker. And I'll be back in a moment. Oh, I should say the minimum wage, speaking of which, the minimum wage now is, in real inflation-adjusted terms, is about where it was in 1954. So this is progress, isn't it? We're about where we were 50 years ago. And let's take a break, listen to this little musical interlude from Nick Sleazy, which is another one of these songs from the remix of The Clash's London Calling. I played this one of them last week, London Booted. And you can download all these songs off the web. Just search for the phrase London Booted, and it will take you there. Let's listen to Nick Sleazy. Bit from McSleazy, a DJ who remixed The Clash's Lost in the Supermarket from their album London Calling, and this is from London Booted, a collection of remixes, one for each song on the album, some of them more distant and complicated than the others, but all quite interesting, and also a way to get back into that wonderful Clash album. And this is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and WBAI.org on the World Wide Web. And now, an interview I recorded a couple of weeks ago with Merrill Guzner, who is author of a book called The $800 Million Pill, The Truth Behind the Cost of New Drugs. He's a former economics correspondent of the Chicago Tribune, and now he's with the Center for Science and the Public Interest in Washington, D.C., and this book published by the University of California Press, Merrill Guzner. The $800 million pill, just what's $800 million?
Well, $800 million, Doug, is the most often used number that the pharmaceutical industry uses for what it costs to develop a single new drug. It's an average. It comes from a Tufts University study. The Tufts Center is called Center for Drug Development, is actually funded by the pharmaceutical industry. And they use this number on Capitol Hill, in the press, to say why they have to charge high prices for drugs. The justification is we're researching the next generation of cures, and it's extraordinarily expensive to do that. $800 million is the average, and that's why you must continue to pay high prices. What I try to do in this book is take a look and dissect that. I look at really what they're spending their R&D money on, but also to look at really where does drug innovation come from? Where do these innovations that people are looking for actually come from, and what do they really cost to make. And I do that by taking a look at some of the more significant medical breakthroughs of the last quarter century.
Let's talk about those in a bit, but anyone who reads the financial pages knows that the pharmaceutical industry is one of the probably consistently the most profitable business of all. So does that have anything to do with the high cost of drugs?
Well, of course, that's the case. From a traditional economist point of view, economics point of view, you would say the high return is as a function of the high risk. But you have to ask yourself a question about how risky can it be if year after year in the Fortune 500 survey done by that magazine, they consistently come up as the most profitable industry. You would think that if there was indeed high risk, you would get years in which they would come up not number one on the list. And yet, and the reason why they are able to do that is a fundamental flaw in their logic, which is that research and development, which is what they spend their money on to develop new drugs, is actually a cost. It's not an investment. And as a result, they are basically charging high prices on old innovation to fund both new research and development and their profits, their labor, all of their other costs. And what we're seeing, of course, is that they can consistently be the most profitable industry, which suggests to you that the actual ostensible reason for high prices, which is innovation, is not the real reason.
Well, if we look, for example, at the computer industry, prices are falling very rapidly there. This is a high-tech industry where prices have been falling consistently for decades. The pharmaceutical industry is, if anything, the opposite. It's a high-tech industry where prices rise relentlessly. What's responsible for the difference between these two?
Well, you've hit on a very interesting question. In fact, that's what got me interested in this whole story about 5 years ago. The the Commission on the Future of Medicare, which President Clinton had appointed, was holding hearings in Washington in order to take a look at how we were going to pay for Medicare and add a prescription drug benefit in the future. And in the course of doing that, the pharmaceutical industry went up to Capitol Hill, and they said, you can't do anything to hold down prices because this will jeopardize innovation. And as a new reporter, a reporter who was new to thinking about this particular high-tech industry, I had, over the course of my reporting career, taking a look at the high-tech industries like the computer industry. And you're exactly right. They always said, if we don't innovate, if we aren't constantly lowering our costs of production, if we aren't coming up with the next generation of products, we will die. We will not be competitive. And you can measure our ability to do that by how much money we're pouring into R&D. And at the same time, there was such fierce competition that the prices, like you pointed out, are coming down. So when I went up there and listened to the pharmaceutical industry during the course of the Medicare Commission debate, I'm listening to this and they're saying, if you don't give us high prices, we won't innovate, as if they had turned the mantra of business completely on its head. And that's actually what got me extremely interested in this whole question in the first place about where do new drugs come from? What do they really cost to make?
Now, my understanding of this business is that the government, mainly, and universities to a lesser extent, really carry out the basic research from which products are made. And an awful lot of the product development just involves tweaking a few molecules to create marginally new drugs that are just mostly like old ones. But the real fundamental breakthroughs come from publicly funded or nonprofit research. Is that a fair...
Yeah, that's the major theme of the $800 million pill. But let's try to dissect this a little bit and use both common sense, but also, let me just say that common sense is, if you look at it in depth, what you come to understand about this industry. One of the things when we talk about innovation in medicine you have to understand is that innovation is rare. How many times do we come up with a really new medicine that has a significant impact on a major disease that is of a major concern to a large number of people? It's actually pretty rare. For a large number of diseases, they are what are called rare diseases. In other words, the patient populations are not very small. So that these, you know, they can be rare cancers, they can be some genetic defects in which the number of patients can be anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 or 30,000 people. So that the drug industry doesn't devote a lot of its resources to that because there's no real market there. So if innovation on the major things that American people are concerned about, like Alzheimer's or many of the broad cancers, in which we still, after many years, not had much impact. If we know that it's rare, you have to ask, why is that the case? And it's simply because we really don't understand the basic mechanisms of those diseases yet. So that being able to therapeutically intervene in disease requires understanding really what causes that disease. There's been some press lately about Alzheimer's, for instance. Well, this is a big concern, especially for aging baby boomers like myself. My father went through a terrible 10-year decline with Alzheimer's. It would be lovely to have a simple pill or treatment that you knew would have a major impact on that disease. The reality is we don't understand it well enough yet, which the common sense kicks in. So where do you get that understanding? You have to pay for basic research. You have to do the science that's going to identify what are the molecular targets where we can intervene. Once you identify them, it requires a lot more work to say, is this really valid? In the drug trade, it's called validating the target. So that all of that kind of research, virtually all of it, takes place in publicly funded institutions. NIH directly, major American public universities or private universities that get NIH grants. There is some foundation funding that goes into a lot of this, the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, the Mayo Clinic. There is patient advocacy groups that, you know, raise charitable funds. The drug industry hires scientists to monitor that research. When a drug target is validated, they're there to jump on it. So it's not to say the drug industry is irrelevant to the development process of drugs. They bring a lot of skills to the party, but they have an apparatus that's looking to market something. When the science matures to the point in any disease state where they can jump on it, they will. But when they're getting as much money as they're getting from the old innovation as they insist they get, then you can begin to look at, well, then what are they doing in their research and development labs besides jumping on the rare things that come along that can have a major impact on disease? And that's what I also take a look at in the book, which is like, where are they spending their money in R&D? And of course, what you discover there is that they're engaged in what I like to call corporate waste. They are developing drugs that are to replace drugs that are coming off patent. They're developing drugs that are just like another drug that some other company is marketing, of which there's many entries already in that, but they don't have one. So they're Me Too, they're called Me Too drugs, so that they can have an entry into that marketplace. And so I would estimate about half of all corporate R&D would fall into this category that I think is most properly categorized as corporate waste.
I'm speaking with Merrill Guzner, who is the author of The $800 Million Pill, The Truth Behind the Cost of New Drugs, just published by University of California Press. Well, let's look at an example, one that has affected the lives of many people, the development of the so-called cocktail to treat AIDS, which came out 8-10 years ago and is really revolutionized the lives of people with AIDS. How has this pharmaceutical arrangement developed?
Well, you know, people who have long enough memories, and it's terrible to think that there's some people around who don't remember the early 1980s when there was nothing to treat AIDS at all. And this was an epidemic that was growing in this country and indeed around the world, that it was truly frightening in proportions. It was the first major epidemic that had come along that was a known killer, and we had no drugs to treat it. And because of the activism of the gay community, which was disproportionately affected by this disease, and other AIDS activists, they forced the United States government, then headed by Ronald Reagan, to begin pouring money into doing the research to come up with something to deal with this devastating plague. Make a long story short, between 1985, when the government began pouring serious resources into this, and 1996, when the AIDS triple cocktail finally won FDA approval, and it was identified, the third leg of the drugs that had been approved, the government spent, it's not an estimate, they actually calculated quite closely, about $10 billion in all levels of drug development and drug research. They actually brought every one of the first three or four AIDS drugs through the entire, from identifying the drug to bringing them through clinical trials. The government actually paid for it and just simply licensed it to private companies. when the protease inhibitor, which was the third leg of the triple cocktail, the story is recounted in my book, but again, to just say when that came along, some of those drugs actually began their lives on government grants. The industry science that got involved in that was totally dependent on government knowledge that was generated by government and researchers around the world who are working on government grants. And if you actually total up everything that industry spent over those 10-year time, I make an estimate in the book that it was really no more than $3 billion. So in other words, like, it was about 3-to-1 government funding over industry funding. Well, because the drug, the triple cocktail, was effective in controlling the disease, doesn't cure it, but it was effective in controlling it, it actually created a huge market for all the drugs that the government had invented and licensed to industry, as well as the new ones that the industry had used government-created knowledge in order to create themselves. But all of a sudden, now you've got a $7 billion a year market. So do the math yourself. $3 billion compared to the $10 billion government expenditure, and now you've got a $7 billion a year global market for HIV medication, HIV/AIDS medications. They're making more money than they invested in R&D almost every year.
And of course, it's become an international political issue because of patents and the expense of the treatment in third world countries. There's big controversy focusing on South Africa, for example. So how does the industry price this stuff, and how do they justify the kinds of price tags they put on it?
Industry pricing can best be described as what the market will bear. And the market will bear what the insurance companies will pay. Often the market will bear, they do an analysis of how much they think they can get out of the market. There is no correlation at all between the cost of developing a drug and the price that's eventually put on it. One of the sad things about this particular industry is that it really sort of exists outside the norms of business practices that exist in every other field. 40 years ago, Senator Estes Kefauver, the late senator from Tennessee, a Democrat, somewhat of a populist, held long hearings on what he called the antibiotic cartel. And he looked at cartel pricing. And this is, in my humble estimation, what goes on in the drug industry. The evidence for it is when you look at all these Me Too drugs that come on the market. You have 3 or 4 companies already selling a drug in a class. Maybe it's a acid indigestion pill. Maybe it's a antihistamine, you know, for allergies. Maybe it's a statin in order to lower your cholesterol. There's already 3 or 4 out there. Now another company decides to bring its drug to market. They've come up with a Me Too drug. It may lower cholesterol slightly better, slightly worse. It does the job as all the others. In any other marketplace, if you're trying to get market share, what would you do? Well, you would think price competition would enter into it. You almost never see price competition in the drug industry. Not significant. Oh, sometimes there's a difference of 10%, perhaps. But not the kind of reductions you see, for instance, when generics come into the market. When a generic comes into the market, it'll lower the price by 50%. Now, the drug industry that is doing its own R&D says, we're going to all keep our prices high because we're going to invest in R&D and come up with the next generation of cures. That's why it's a circular argument. So you're right back to where you started, where I took off and trying to research this whole industry and saying, all right, where do drugs really come from? How much do they really cost to make? Do you really need to have these high prices with no price competition, sanctioned in many ways by the government in the sense that it never does the normal investigation of cartel-like behavior against the industry because the government, and this is bipartisan going back many years, basically accepts the industry argument that it's the only source of innovation.
How does the industry keep prices up? Do they collude? Is it winks and nods? Is it some other structure of the market?
I think that whether it's the wink and a nod, it's not out-and-out collusion. It's they price similarly. But, you know, the automobile industry prices similarly as well. And they don't collude in order to price similarly. But if you look at the margins of the automobile industry and you look at the margins of the pharmaceutical industry, what you would say about the automobile industry is this is an industry in which margins are razor thin because there's real competition between auto companies. And they just will, they're going to make a profit, but it's going to be the profit that they can make on selling a car. If I sell a Ford Taurus and Honda sells a Honda Accord and I go into the marketplace, they're both going to cost me, you know, around $20,000 a year. And they're not going to go too much lower than that, although every year the industry tries to wring more costs out of the cost of a car. But they're not going to go too much lower because they're just simply down to the narrowest margin they have. But if I'm a new drug company, if I've got a new drug in a class of drugs, and I'm making a 30% margin, and I look at the competitors in that class of drug, say the statins, for instance, and they're making 30% margins overall in their corporate structure from the sale of all their drugs, and you know you can't tell for an individual drug, but you know that there's a 30% margin that the drug industry is making, you would think somebody with a new entry would say, you know, I could have a lower margin, steal market share, and make money. And it doesn't happen. So that's the issue here. It becomes, they understand that to break ranks is to undercut the fundamental argument that they all have for high prices, which is without high prices, there will be no innovation. And that's why I thought it was so important to take on that argument.
Well, if we look at our neighbor to the north, for example, Canada, they sell very similar drugs to what we get at lower prices. Most countries with national health systems have much lower drug prices than we do. This recently became very apparent in the Medicare drug reform, in which Congress forbade the government from using its buying power to lower prices and tried to forbid imports from Canada. What about this? Well, let's talk about that Medicare bill. What do you make of that thing?
Well, what the Medicare bill did, besides providing an inadequate benefit for most senior citizens, I mean, they did get, let's give credit where credit is due, for political reasons largely, but still, we have now enshrined in public policy that it is the policy of the United States government to have prescription drugs as part of the Medicare system. Senior citizens are 60% of the overall drug market. They are the ones who are on fixed incomes. They are in the high drug consumption years. It's critical that we provide meaningful drug coverage for senior citizens because drugs have become a much more important part of modern medicine than they were 40 years ago when, under President Lyndon Johnson, we created the Medicare system and we covered hospital costs. In those days, you went into a hospital if you got sick. Today, you have high blood pressure or whatever, you're much more likely to start taking pills as you get older. So it's important that we have a prescription drug benefit. So let's just say that the principle now is in law and we've got to work to improve it. But at the same time that they passed the bill, they put in things that literally tied the government's hands from being a decent benefit. Two ways. One was, of course, there's the huge donut hole, and I don't think you want to get into talking about, you know, the inadequacies of the coverage because it is very inadequate, even at current dollar values, which are very high. But the reason why the current dollar expenditure from the government does not buy enough for the average senior citizen is because of the way the government's hands were tied. What did they do? They specifically prohibited them from negotiating high, you know, prices, being a single buyer in the market, and establishing formularies. A formulary in the drug trade is where you decide we're going to have a list of preferred drugs to buy. Now, in order to establish a formulary, you need to have scientific information that determines what is the best drug for a particular condition. And with the drug industry basically in control of the clinical trial process in this country, what you don't get is good objective information about what is the best drug to buy, what is the most cost-effective drug to buy. The government could provide this information by establishing an institute of clinical practice in which it engaged in systematic clinical trials and would compare all the different medications in a particular class. It could compare the different classes against each other when you have these five or six different classes of blood control medications. Okay? Should you start on a diuretic, which has been around since the 1950s and costs pennies a day? Or should you start on an ACE inhibitor or a calcium channel blocker, which are still on patent and may cost you $4 or $5 or $6 a day? Which should you start on? Has anybody compared the two? Well, in fact, This was one case, and I bring it up, where the government actually did engage in a comparative clinical trial over a number of years, and they found out, lo and behold, that the cheap diuretic that's been around since the 1950s as a first use of blood pressure control medications for most people is very effective, just as effective as all the newer classes of medication. There was just a study published recently in the Journal of the American Medical Association that said that if this were to become clinical practice by physicians out there, the government, that the societal bill, if you will, for this particular class of medications would go down by over $1 billion a year. This was an $80 million government study that if it actually was allowed to be put into policy by the establishment of a government formulary and the government actually directly buying drugs, could save over $1 billion a year. So in passing the Medicare prescription drug bill last fall, Tom Scully, who was the head of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, who was the architect of this bill, who then went to work for the private sector to help companies negotiate through the new maze that was created, very typical behavior, you know, one might parenthetically say. But the point is that they slipped into this legislation things that would tie the government's hands from being a cost-effective purchaser in the market. That's why you see now the debate in Congress is to have people go over the border to buy drugs from Canada. Well, you know, I'm all for free trade, but, you know, trying to import somebody's rational medical system by slipping over the border seems to me not the way to go about this. What we have to do is create a rational healthcare system in this country that provides consumers and physicians with objective scientific information that allows them to be not only rational, but cost-effective consumers in the drug marketplace.
Let's conclude then on a look towards the future. You're in Washington now, and are we condemned to this system for the foreseeable future, or is there any hope for breaking out of it?
Well, you know, I really do believe that the prescription drug benefit issue is in some ways a harbinger of the debate that can only grow over the next 10 years. The fact is that the Medicare system does have a date with destiny, and it's the date with the baby boom, and it's going to expand and cost the amount of the economy that healthcare can begin to absorb. Just it runs up against its natural limits. We're already at 15% of GDP being used by healthcare. The fastest growing expense within that is prescription drugs. They're growing at 10-20% a year. At some point, you know, it's like the old game of Wonder Ball. It's got to stop. And there's two ways to have it stop. One is just to have it stop by rationing health care, throwing people off the train. And the other way to do it is just to say, no, let's spend our drug dollars wisely so that everybody can have decent health care. And I think that as the baby boom ages, there's more people who, you know, are going to be told that it's going to be half of your retirement income to keep up with the cost of drugs or whatever, that I think that there will be a constituency for having a more rational healthcare system.
More rational. That would be an innovation in American life, wouldn't it? That was Merrill Guzner, who is the author of the book The $800 Million Pill, The Truth Behind the Cost of the New Drugs, just published by the University of California Press. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back in a couple of weeks with a fundraising special on the State of the Empire. Blockbuster guests to be announced. Stay tuned for the news and on to the evening, and let's go out with this appropriate cover of Bo Diddley's classic Pills, done in the 1970s by the New York Dolls.